Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Brian Brigham of The Modern Gentleman, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s, Volume 3, coming up November 16th in Ontario. We'll have details later in the program. First, though, poetry, in the form of a new book and with several readings and events in the very near future. KVCR's Benjamin Perper has more.
You're listening to KVC Arts, and we're with L.I. Henley, author of the new book Whole Night Through. And Lauren, I have to ask how to describe this book. Is it a book-length narrative, a novel in lyrics, a poem monologue? How do you describe it?
The short answer is yes to all that you just said. It's definitely a genre bender, a hybrid piece, you know, that's imbued with the lyricism and musicality of the poem, but also the narrative arc and character development from the novel. As you know, it's about 120 pages of poetry, which is too long for a straight poetry book, but it's the length of a novella.
Yeah.
So I've been calling it a novella in verse, but I also think that's not still fully capturing what Whole Night Through is. But luckily, poets get other poets to write about their books and sometimes say it much better than the author of the work. So the poet James Cushing, who's really familiar with my work and is a longtime friend and mentor, he's calling it in the blurb a book-length narrative, persona poem sequence, novel and lyrics, poem for voices, dream screenplay, and then he also says we can invent a genre label later. I like that.
Yeah, I like the dream one. That's nice.
I like that too, and it sort of speaks to the fragmentation of the narrative. Yeah, and then poet Roxanne Beth Johnson called it noir. She said it was moody, sultry noir, and that, you know, we have this main character, Ella, who's essentially the heroine, but then the other characters, in her words, make up a Greek chorus.
Yeah.
And I really like that, too. So, big thanks to them for help with that.
Yeah. I was going to say, Ella does seem to be the main character, the kind of heroine. Do you identify her with her the most, or is there another character that you identify with the most?
Yeah, Ella is the heroine of the story. And if we're looking at this like a desert noir, she's also the femme fatale. She's in her early 20s. She's restless. She's bored. In a rural space. She's alone. She has no older female mentor to show her the way. She's separated from her hometown in Florida and from her horse, who is representative, I think, of her strength and her agency and her strong will, her independence, all of what she desperately needs to stay in contact with if she's going to make it through her early 20s. I can relate to her a lot. Absolutely. I definitely felt very cut off from my sense of agency and who I was as a person at that age. But I also have to say that I actually can connect with all of them, which once you read the book and you know how volatile some of the characters are, that might make you worry a little bit about me. But part of my becoming what I would call, you know, a whole person, which is still very much a work in progress, of course, is being on speaking terms with my shadow, with my, you know, darker sides, which we all have. We don't talk about them. I mean, Robert Bly called it the long bag we drag behind us. It's full of all the dark parts of ourselves we've shoved down, and the bag gets longer and longer as we age, unless we're on speaking terms with our socially unacceptable parts of ourselves. So I can relate to even Michael, who is definitely the darkest, most dangerous, volatile, scary character in there. And actually, I love myself more and act more in accordance with my values now that I've spent time throughout the years unburying these little skeletons, and my writing has gotten better. We don't have any initiations for facing darkness. In America, we only have ceremonies intended to purify, and I think that's a mistake. But writing can be that initiation. And speaking of shadow and being on speaking terms with, you know, the shadowy parts of ourselves. I'm teaching a 2-day collaborative workshop with symbolist painter Zara Khan on light and shadow in painting and poetry the first weekend of November. So for people who might be interested in that, they can reach out to me through my website.
What is your website?
It is www.lihenley.com.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And you told me that a teacher at Crafton taught this book, and the class identified with Michael the most, or they liked Michael the most, and he's really, like you said, the darkest and kind of most violent character in this book. So was that surprising?
Yes and no. I mean, actually, it was a very surprising comment from an undergrad, you know, at the community college, like, wow, that was really astute. And actually, what the student said was, we're not supposed to love Michael. She said, Ella's having an affair with Michael, but so are all of we. So,
wow.
You know, it's, he's really complicated, and he's a really interesting character, and he sort of wears his emotions and his damage on his sleeve, and so we really get to understand him and know him. And also, he was the victim of abuse from his father, and you know, we feel for him. And so really it felt like quite a success for me when I heard from several members of the class that that they felt this way about Michael, because my goal with all of these personas was to create empathy for unlikable people, unlikable characters. And so I guess I did that.
Yeah, you certainly did. How long did you work on Whole Night Through? Because it's really, like you said, it's for a piece of poetry, if that's what it is, it's pretty long. So how long did you work on it?
I wrote the first draft in maybe 6 to 8 months, and it was an everyday, every morning thing. I was compelled to follow it down until it was done. And so, you know, after that first initial draft, which I think was like 150 pages, I had lots of people read it and, you know, write comments and give me all their criticism and feedback. And then I took a break because that's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Instead of just diving right back in, when you have a first draft of something, it's a really good idea to sort of fold it away and take some time away from it and then come back to it with clear eyes. But on the other hand, people who are, I've heard from novelists that they really don't want to take too much time away from the novel because they want to keep hearing the voices of the characters, and they don't, you know, they don't want to take too long because they'll start to feel disconnected from it. But I think after getting that first draft down, it was okay for me to take a break. But anyways, I came back to it and revised and took a lot of poems out, even poems that I really liked, I took out, because I didn't think that they were essential to the narrative. Yeah, so all in all, I would say maybe about a year, year and a half total.
Wow. And there are a lot of elements in the book that seem to correspond with your life, just knowing things about you. So how autobiographical is this book?
So much about Ella, in particular, is in line with my years between 18 and 24, which were extremely turbulent, and I know that they are for a lot of people. We're actually still adolescents at that point. Like, our brain is literally not done growing yet.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you turn 18 and, you know, people start calling you an adult, and it really couldn't be any further from the truth. When I was a child and even a young teen, it seemed that I had all the confidence that I needed. I knew who I was, and I was really into self-preservation. I was focused on my writing, my art, my schoolwork. I felt really unstoppable. And then when I had to move out of my mother's house at 18, I just fell into a kind of free fall. And it seemed like I was sort of looking for men to sort of catch me, like they were going to break my fall in some way. I remember my last summer at home in the extremely rural town of Landers. I'm talking like windswept desert, sand and miles of nothing, you know, a post office and a moose lodge. and my parents were gone on vacation for weeks on end, and I was all by myself. All my friends had left for college or their trip to Europe. I remember feeling so bored and so desperately hungry for attention that I really would have gotten into anybody's car, which is a really hard thing to say. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of young people who live in the Mojave and other rural spaces that feel that way. And it gets them into trouble that they can't handle. It makes them vulnerable to violence that can change the course of their life forever, especially women. And of course, this is a story about generational violence and domestic violence. And maybe what I can say is that the loneliness of this book is autobiographical. I can pull from that time period of my life for a long time. Like I could write multiple novels just based off of that extreme loneliness that I felt at that time. So the getting lost, the tempting of fate, the brushes and near misses with danger, all of that is definitely autobiographical. And of course I knew people like the dangerous and volatile Michael and his horribly abusive authoritarian father. I knew people like that growing up here. And young boys who were, you know, started out quite sensitive, but who maybe had military fathers or paramilitary fathers or just, you know, other fathers who were sort of forcing them into this mold that they didn't fit into, and that caused a lot of problems. And, you know, young women who became the victims of violence and disappeared. But unlike Ella, I made it out through luck and whatever else. But Ella, we can surmise, does not make it out, as many women of rural spaces do not.
That's L.I. Henley in conversation with KVCR's Benjamin Perper. More at lihenley.com, lihenley.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org.
The Mojave Desert seems to be another character here in this novel. It's certainly a very vibrant setting. Can you kind of speak to that?
Yeah, the desert is another character for sure. I think I learned the importance of landscape and place having its own distinct presence from authors like Cormac McCarthy, Flannery O'Connor, Carson McCullers, Toni Morrison. And having grown up in Joshua Tree and Landers, the landscape was a presence in my life. I was an only child, and my parents worked full-time. I had a lot of time to myself. So I talked to the trees and to the dirt and tried to tell the howling wind to be quiet so I could sleep. You know, it is an invading force in the desert, the wind and the heat and the flash floods. It is a presence, and you have to be aware of it. In the novella, all of the characters have a strong connection to the earth. Ella and her mother, Helena, are connected to the hot springs and the swamps and the Suwannee River of Florida. Jake, Ella's husband, is very much connected to water and trees. Michael, as troubled as he is, has a really close relationship with animals. There are recurring images of caves and wells, cellars, underground water. Yeah, I think all of the characters have an urgency to return to the earth in some way. Like, they feel really tormented by being separated from the source that we all sprang from. I really want for the physical landscape of my stories and my poems to be a projection of the emotional landscape shared by the characters.
Yeah, and speaking of animals with Michael, but really a lot of the characters in the book, horses come up a lot. Can you speak to why that is? And did you have horses growing up, or what is that?
I didn't. I did not. I mean, I spent some time at a neighbor's house that did have horses, and I mean, place your hand on the head of a horse near their snout and feel that heat, and just the fact that they are gentle, but they could crush you in a moment as well. Yeah. I sort of had a bit of a fear and a respect for horses, which I think is an appropriate emotion.
Yeah.
For something so large. And, you know, the United States has an interesting history in regards to horses and taming horses and taming the West. And Yeah, I don't know why. I really don't actually know why I had Ella be so connected to the horse, but it felt like it was sort of her totem.
Mm-hmm.
That it could be, should be wild and free and independent, but is so often our beast of burden and captured and not free.
Yeah. So your previous works have been books of poetry, also many about the Mojave Desert and echoing many of the themes here, but not in the same narrative form that we find in Whole Night Through. So what inspired you to write something with a distinct character set and a distinct story like this?
Well, I started out as a fiction writer, so I've always loved storytelling. And I have a background in theater and performance, so getting to write this piece was like putting together all of my loves for storytelling and theater and creating characters. My favorite kinds of novels and movies and plays are totally character-driven. I have a few characters. I mean, I like to have a few characters in a room together, and just, like, the narrative arc of human drama is enough for me. So I grew up reading plays that just had a couple of characters in them, like No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre, that French play God of Carnage, Night's Mother, which is just a mother and a daughter. And then, of course, I love movies like The Sunshine Limited. Really, it's just, you know, a couple of people in a room. I think that's really enough. To me, that's all the plot you need, because plot should be character-driven. It should spring out of the kinds of decisions that these characters would make. And if you know your characters really well, plot takes care of itself. The drama just unfolds if you listen to them. So yeah, I wanted to write something really character-driven with a fragmented plot so that there was room for interpretation of events and replay value. I want people to get to the end of Whole Night Through and say, oh, I need to go back. I need to go back and read that again. You know, I got to see exactly why, you know, this person did what they did, or, you know, maybe I missed something important for this relationship here. I want them to have to go back. Yeah, and I also really wanted to be able to give readers just enough information at one time to keep them turning the page. Ben Percy is an amazing fiction writer. He talks about dangling carrots of suspense. And as soon as you give them your reader a bite of the carrot, there needs to be another one swinging just out of breach, right? So
there's that
yeah.
horse
and I also,
metaphor again.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to say I also wanted the narrative to mimic the way memory works, which is that, you know, memory is not linear. It's not whole. It's very fragmented. It's slippery. It's fleeting.
Yeah. I said there's that horse metaphor again with the carrots.
Right. Exactly.
So the novel is set in 49 Palms in the Mojave Desert. That's a nod to 29 Palms, right?
Yes, it is. For people who live in Southern California, they know most likely that I'm alluding to 29 Palms. If you don't live here, you probably don't know, unless you're hearing this interview, of course. And there are places in 29 Palms, saloons, and stores whose names I use directly. But I decided, right before the book went to print, that I wanted to give it a slightly different name, because the violence that happens in this book, it's a fictional depiction of real violence that happens every day in America. And if I called it 29 Palms, I think it's too easy for people to compartmentalize violence and think, that's a violent town. I'm glad I don't live there. But you do live there. You know, there is no border around violence. It's pervasive. And one reason why I wanted to write this book is because rates of domestic violence, which includes violence towards children and spouses, has increased nationwide. And according to the CDC, more than half of female homicide victims are killed by an intimate partner. So this is not a 29 Palms problem. This is an American problem. So that's why I changed the name just sort of slightly, because I want people to realize that this town is everywhere. This town is their town.
So what's next for you? What are you working on now? You mentioned you have an upcoming reading and class you're teaching. So what's next for you?
Yeah, I'm trying to go back and work on some fiction that maybe I abandoned a while ago and see what's there. You know, there was a reason I started writing it, so I want to go back and explore that a little bit more. So I'm working on short stories, and I'm always working on poetry. It's a constant in my life. I wrote a collaborative chat book with poet Jennifer K. Sweeney that is being sent out right now, and another collaborative chat book with Laura Mayer. I'm really into collaboration. So yeah, I am teaching this collaborative workshop with an oil painter. Her name's Zara Kond. She's an incredible symbolist oil painter, and we're doing a collaborative workshop where you don't necessarily have to be a poet or a painter, but you should be interested in doing both and seeing the ways in which the two mediums overlap. Yeah, I'm into collaboration. I'm into teaching private workshops out here in the desert, and I'm also doing a lot of cooking.
Nice.
Lots of cooking. Yeah, I like to have my poker and mini fires at one time. Keeps life interesting.
Definitely.
I'm also going to be giving a reading with Patty Sayburn on November 9th at Olive Market in Redlands at 3 p.m.
Cool.
Those are the readings I have going on. Yeah.
Speaking of readings, can you read some stuff for us?
I would love to. Yeah. So this is one of Ella's poems. Just to give a very brief synopsis. Ella has moved with her young Marine husband, Jake, from Branford, Florida, to this compilation of places, 49 Palms, in the Mojave Desert, and she lives on the base, and she's been having an affair with her character, Michael. So here's one of Ella's poems. First time I was alone with Michael, I left my glasses at home. He was a totem pole carved from red cedar and mounted in a shadowy corner of the adobe bar. "Hello, neighbor," he said, and I recognized him despite the raccoon mask over his eyes, the eagle wings frozen mid-flight, the white antlers covered in dust. We went out back behind the dumpsters so we could hear each other speak. A little dust fell like snow from his velvet skull bones. "I'm not always like this," he said. "Usually, I'm just one thing." Then he listed what he's seen burn. Domes, horses, dump trucks, birds on a fence. "Even objects scream," he said. And we drank whiskey from a flask until we were half asleep, leaning into a slow, slow dance.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me on.
That was L.I. Henley in conversation with KVCR's Benjamin Perper. Again, more on her new book, as well as information on upcoming events at lihenley.com. Once again, lihenley.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Coming up November 16th, it's Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. The lineup includes Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, Jimmy Clanton, and the Modern Gentlemen, who in a different setting also serve as the Four Seasons when accompanying Frankie Valli. I spoke with Brian Brigham, one of a few of the Modern Gentlemen who are from our region. Before becoming one of the Four Seasons, which then led to the Modern Gentlemen, did you grow up, and I use this term lovingly, by the way, did you grow up a theater geek and have audition opportunities due to proximity? What I'm trying to do is hit that area that eventually led up to TV and film credits, including General Hospital, all that.
Yeah, I got the bug in high school. I did the show choir. That's kind of where it led. And then I quickly, from there, went to a college music program and did musicals, did regional productions, national tours. and that sort of thing, and worked at theme parks in that arena. So it was a lot of musicals. So I'm definitely a theater geek.
Okay, gotcha. Myself as well. And so it's just one of those things you do. There's summer stock during certain times of the year, and then there's, okay, what do I do with the degree? And then, so there's that. I guess with that, some of these film credits you have listed, General Hospital, Boston Legal, and Jimmy Kimmel, etc. So with General Hospital, what'd you get? Did you have a role, or were you maybe third intern on the left, or a bit of both there?
I had what they call under five, so I did it about six times where you get under five lines that you could do, and I played an orderly in the mental ward. My name was Howard Billings.
Nice. That's really cool. Okay, excellent. Now, I won't really ask you William Shatner stories for Boston Legal, unless there are some really cool ones and you can just stop me right now. But you have performed with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons since 2003, is that correct?
Yeah, that's when I first started the group.
First started or first brought it back? That's what I'm trying to sort out here. Frankie Valli being among the et ceteras as far as the rest of your credits. We are seeing the four of you as a group, but did the four of you come on board as the Four Seasons at the same time? They were starting it up again. Are you guys slowly replacing former Four Seasons?
Well, the first of the four of us was Todd Fournier. So he started in 2002. Frankie took a little break from performing for a while and brought the group back on tour again. And Todd was one of the first guys to come back with the group. And then this is way before Jersey Boys. So his popularity wasn't as big as it is now, of course. So
yeah.
A lot of guys would come and go because there was maybe one or two performances a month, which isn't enough to kind of sustain you with one job. So people would come and go. And then there was another audition late 2002, 2003, where my brother, Landon, myself, and a few other gentlemen auditioned for the band. There was only two spots available at that time, so myself and Landon joined in 2003, and then soon after, one of our members in the group left to do something else. There was an opening for the first tenor role, and my brother, they knew him really well at that point, and we brought him into the fold, and we were the actual Four Seasons with Frankie, the longest than anybody else in the group. So about 11, 12 years the four of us were together.
I think longer than the original Four Seasons.
Yeah, I think we are the longest tenured singers that he's had. And that's, you know, right when Jersey Boys started, we were the guys. We, you know, got to go on Broadway a couple of times, perform with symphony orchestras and travel and really get to see that resurgence of the group, which was really exciting for us.
Had you been a fan of this type of thing before starting to sing it, or was it, oh man, it's a job? But okay, now you like it. Okay, that's cool. But I'm looking at way back when.
Yeah, no, I mean, we all sing his songs. You know, I might not have known it with Frankie in the Four Seasons, but I knew the music. That was the first thing, because I was raised singing those things, and my brother and I always grew up singing harmony and that sort of thing. We sung in barbershop and doo-wop groups growing up. So I always loved the vocal harmonies and things like that. So I was always listening to the Four Freshmen and those awesome groups.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Brian Brigham of The Modern Gentleman, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3, along with Jimmy Clanton, Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, and MC'd by Wink Martindale. That's in Ontario, November 16th, more at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. December 1963, this is a song that, well, I have to say, for the longest time, I didn't know that Frankie wasn't singing the first couple of stanzas of it. Even the original recordings, I just always thought it was Frankie Valli, and then there were these other guys that were singing in the background. Had no idea the way that it has been and still is actually presented, but now it's tightly choreographed. I know you're coming out and clasping hands and doing the chest bump and all that kind of thing, and, you know, just, hey, it's good to be here kind of thing, but it is really a choreographed event nowadays, I think, more than maybe it used to be. there were incarnations of the Four Seasons before this current lineup that did very much this type of thing as well.
Yeah, when we got brought in, it was a different kind of setup, you know, where it went from the Four Seasons being musicians playing instruments to four younger seasons, if you will, that come in and kind of be more of a show where, this is before Jersey Boys and they did all that, but we had a choreographer and we were brought in to bring that youthful energy and sing all the background harmonies and do all the dance steps. And so we had a choreographer rather teach us all the steps and that sort of thing, and it's kind of how it formed.
Okay. You know, it's something that has clearly evolved over the years, but I was absolutely a child when the original version came out, and far from it now. But anyway, I've seen some changes over the years on that one. Some more background, really. I will actually talk about The Modern Gentleman coming up here, but I have to know, with the theater credits shared among the four of you, I'm not so curious if you were in the same productions together, although you and your brother wouldn't surprise me, but I'm curious if within the four of you, we have a couple of Dannys from Greece or a couple of Judases singing in the same group these days.
Yeah, I definitely play Danny. You know, I had that role down. I couldn't escape the John Travolta roles. I played Danny in Greece. I did Tony Manero, Saturday Night Fever, the national tour. We actually played at the California Theater in San Bernardino, so that was a lot of fun.
You have other John Travolta roles ahead of you then, I would think, if you keep on doing that.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. He played Edna in Hairspray, so I don't know if I want to see that one.
No, don't. Okay.
Yeah.
Another side thing, and I think people would enjoy this, especially in this area. Again, amongst your credits, as an LA studio singer, I'd like to hear about, you know, maybe what's something that we could possibly have heard or still hear your voice on, even though we're not seeing you at all. You know, some car dealership, or find it at Staedtler Brothers, or that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes we get calls to sing with the orchestra for the movie. So we're singing on the score of the actual movie, and there'll be like a choir. And I really enjoy that, being brought in and singing. And it's all the oohs and ahs that you don't really pay attention to unless you're into that sort of thing. So I got to sing on some movie scores, which is a lot of fun, and also got to sing background on a lot of performances of American Idol and the house band and The Voice and America's Got Talent and all those shows. So it's fun to be in the background sometimes and be heard and not necessarily seen.
I would really think so. I think more so the behind-the-scenes stuff in the world of theater and even in radio. Well, radio, I'm kind of isolated in my own little booth here. You mentioned The Voice and America's Got Talent and all that kind of stuff. Were you on for a full season having to learn stylistic approach after stylistic approach after all these hopefuls come on?
Yeah, so we would be, like American Idol, for example, I would sub in with the house band. So a friend of mine was singing with them and Dancing with the Stars, so he couldn't be two places at once. So he'd give me a call, and I did it for two seasons, kind of in the background, and I would learn kind of what the song was going to be for the taping the day before, and we'd rehearse with the contestants, and then sometimes we would be on camera, we'd be doing some choreography behind them, or sometimes, like I said earlier, we'd just be heard. And so it was a lot of different styles, of course, which is a lot of fun, and it keeps your chops up as a singer.
I have watched you on the shore, standing by the ocean's roar. Do you love me?
Well, at some point, you guys went from, you know, and I don't want to say it's in past tense, because one would hope, knock on wood, there's Four Seasons gigs will continue. But at some point, you, as it says, finely tuned your signature sound to the iconic Frank Sinatra hits. And so this is where we're going from the Four Seasons to the Modern Gentleman lineup. So what is different with the Modern Gentleman lineup versus a Four Seasons lineup? I mean, beyond the fact, of course, one has Frankie Valli, the other one doesn't. But are you guys singing in a different register, maybe, than you normally would? Or do your harmonies come together in different ways from when you're with Valli?
Yeah, it's much different. So Frankie would hear us sing, and we would express our love for harmonies, and his favorite artist growing up was Sinatra. So he always wanted to do a project with a group in his favorite groups like the Four Freshmen and the High Lows, but do it as a tribute to Sinatra. So in the studio, he brought us in, and we recorded basically a whole album of Sinatra hits in the four-part harmony, and that's kind of what gave us our signature sound and singing all those close, tight-knit harmonies, which is very different from the Four Seasons rock and roll. So that's kind of how it started us as kind of a quartet and developed a sound within the four of us. And then we decided we should take this on the road and start touring and doing different things. And that's just one aspect of the show that we do. So in our show, we actually just do a very small portion of Four Seasons music in our show. We do a lot of Motown. We do a lot of jazz. We do Beach Boys, Bee Gees, anything that over the past five decades of favorite groups of ours, Stevie Wonder, we'll cover it within the four of us, which is something that we have a lot of fun doing.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Coming up November 16th at Gardner Spring Auditorium in Ontario, it's Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. But the lineup includes Jimmy Clanton, who we heard from last week, Paul and Paula, Bobby Rydell, Brian Hyland, Dodie Stevens, and the Modern Gentlemen. The Modern Gentlemen also serve as the Four Seasons when backing Frankie Valli, but they developed their own sound along the way, with music from all over the map with a few common elements.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone to help.
It seems like you're looking for things that the audience will have fun hearing and seeing, but things that you guys will enjoy with your harmonies.
Yeah, that's exactly it. We knew that we had to branch out and even do like classic rock hits. So we'll do a big genre of music because we know our audience is growing, and we want to continue doing what we love for many years to come.
Some of your fans, some of the folks that come to see your show, they may have started, well, when Sinatra did, but you're passing it on to other folks too, and I want to address that in a little bit. So it seems like this was Frankie Valli's idea or notion to put you guys together for all these Sinatra tunes. It wasn't you guys just loving the stuff, and it finally came together that way.
Well, it came from a love, obviously, from us, and he saw that. But it was a project that he wanted to help us get off the ground, to help us with our career.
Gotcha.
And that's kind of where it did start. So there are 10 songs that are done. It just, you know, he has them kind of, you know, locked up there, and we're just that. But that's how it started, and then we started moving on from there and taking it on our own. And then that's kind of how we created the Modern Gentleman.
Okay. But this one is available. I mean, people can get it these days, right? At the Modern Gentleman, is it .org or .net?
.net. The Modern Gentleman .net. We do have a CD available. It's our Volume 1, kind of our favorite. It's not the Sinatra album, but it's the Volume 1, the kind of our favorite hits of Motown, Beach Boys, Beatles, and some Four Seasons, of course.
Fantastic. Okay. Does Frankie have any notion as to the release, or is it, you know, up to the producers, other producers at this point, but the release for the Sinatra stuff?
Well, we haven't talked about it in a while because we've been so busy doing our tour,
sure.
But, you know, he's never quite satisfied. He always wants to do something different or put a spin on it. And so, like, well, we got to move on, but let us know when you're ready, boss, you know?
Sweet, yeah. Well, you can't exactly demand it from him, yeah. What was the first Sinatra tune or you know, older non-Four Seasons type of material that was, one, tossed around and sung for fun, maybe, and then, two, recorded?
There's 10 songs that we recorded. There is Nancy with the Laughing Face, which was a really pretty arrangement that we had. The guy that actually did all the arrangements, his name is Artie Schreck. He originally arranged Can't Take My Eyes Off You for Frankie in 67. So that was really cool getting to work with him in the studio and his amazing arrangements. But there's so many good tunes, All the Way, Young at Heart, Come Fly With Me, Witchcraft, and a lot of like kind of not so popular songs of his that I really enjoyed getting to know and learn and sing.
Like what, for example? I mean, like Summer Wind or That's Life or what's some of these?
Well, like we did this really cool a cappella version of In the Wee Small Hours. That's one of my favorite ones that we did.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm a huge jazz nut, and so really when I think of Sinatra, beyond so much of his work, I really go back to like the Count Basie-Sinatra combination. So anyway, it's just great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hopefully, you know, even beyond this one waiting to be released, hopefully there will be other discs in the works. And so I'd be curious what maybe got passed up for this disc and then making sure that it's included for the next. Anything on the table?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, I think there was a couple of those. You know, we wanted to do, like, you know, Night and Day, and there's a Lady of the Tramp, a couple of those that we just thought would be fun. But, I mean, again, there's 10 songs that we had that were really cool, and we do some of them live, so we will do one or two of those at the upcoming show on the 16th of November, so
beautiful.
It'll be a lot of fun.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming up November 16th, it's Legends of the 60s Volume 3 in Ontario. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. But the lineup includes Jimmy Clanton, Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, and The Modern Gentleman, a quartet including tonight's guest, Brian Brigham. One of the other gigs, I would say, that you were fortunate to get, you had your own residency in Atlantic City for a bit. And so again, how did this come about? And what was it? Is it like a Vegas gig where you've got, you know, six nights a week, two times a day? How did this kind of thing work? And first of all, though, how did it come about for you?
We had an agent that kind of reached out to us and asked if we'd like to do a summer residency. So that just happened in August. We were there for the whole month. And it was a great experience getting to do your own, like, sit-down show for an entire month in the summer in Atlantic City. You know, it's very similar to the Vegas thing where there's all those casinos. And for most people that maybe have not been there, it's on the boardwalk. And you got all these really cool casinos and just iconic places that, you know, Sinatra's played and Frankie has played. And and so we were fortunate to do our own sit-down residency with The Modern Gentleman. And it was incredible. We had a live band, which a lot of people don't do there these days, but we had our own live band. It was fun getting to meet new people, new fans, and connect with them. So that was a really great experience for us.
It just absolutely had to have been. I wouldn't have thought that they'd be tracking people or like having people perform with tracks in Atlantic City, but that's the case, huh? Yeah, a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, sometimes, you know, there's a lot of groups out there that, you know, they don't think about flying a band, and it can get, like, logistically is where it becomes sometimes if you're really trying to make a name for yourself, it's all those things kind of add up. So you got to figure out, oh, do I know any musicians on the East Coast, or am I going to fly people in? And sometimes people choose to use tracks, professionally track shows. But in our show, we have so much energy and we really feed off the live musicians that, you know, we'll work from everybody. If we can have a horn section, we'll have them up there. So we really love live music.
Phenomenal. Yeah, working with a live band, it's absolutely, well, there's the timing. There's the human timing element of it. So that's, again, incredible. Well, I'm really happy, wrapping up pretty quickly here, I'm really happy to hear that you're doing beyond the Sinatra stuff. You do throw in Four Seasons material, even when Frankie's not with you. I realize I just said Frankie's not with you as opposed to you're not with Frankie. I should really restate that.
Yeah, well, he gave us his blessing. You know, we talked to him, and it, you know, after almost 15 years individually and then together for 12 as a group, it was just time for us to move on, and he knew that, and, you know, he helps us. I still call him frequently and pick his brain and ask for advice, and, you know, the next thing for us now moving forward is to create some original music, and that's kind of where we've been lately in the studio, is kind of coming up with some ideas that we can reach that next generation and still have that classic, timeless feel to these songs where you can sing along and the melodies are good, the stories are good, and that's kind of what's next for the modern gentleman.
I'm so glad to hear you mention that next generation kind of thing. And one with things like Pitch Perfect and the a cappella craze, I would have to say, that's out there. I read somewhere it's written that the four of you are fortunate to be curators of an amazing songbook, in essence. And curators, as opposed to singers, that's really nice. And again, so much of your audience will be much older, but I'm sure I'd love to hear about some time that you know that you really introduced this music to someone, a child or a high schooler, who knows what, but, you know, somebody beyond the years that someone would expect being a fan of Sinatra or Frankie mm-hmm. Valli.
Well, it's amazing. Sometimes, you know, you'll get the more mature people in the audience and they'll bring their grandchildren. But there's a lot of movies these days that are using those songs. And so they'll recognize it and then they make the connection and then they see it live and they oh, I've seen it in this movie or I've seen it on this TV show that I like. And then we do meet and greets after every show. So we meet the people. We like talking to the people, especially the younger people. And because we grew up as kids listening to this music, and it's, you know, 50, 60 years old, some of these songs, and we want it to continue another 50 and 60 years. So that's why we look at ourselves as curators of the songbook. And I think we take a great responsibility doing so, because we were fortunate enough to work with Frankie, and we got to share the stage with the real Beach Boys and Manhattan Transfer and kind of be that next generation that can bring it to the next group.
Fantastic. I couldn't have written a better rap. I've been speaking with Brian Brigham of The Modern Gentleman, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3, along with Jimmy Clanton, Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, Bobby Rydell, and emceed by Wink Martindale. That's in Ontario, November 16th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to L.I. Henley and to Brian Brigham. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wadd, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. It's quick and easy at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.